Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Real Talk, a movie podcast. We are your go-to source for ratings and recommendations of past and present films. I am your host, Wes Jones, podcasting from Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Hey, this is Tommy, podcasting straight from Nashville, Tennessee.
The Movie Buddy Conway, podcasting from Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Hey, Real Talk listeners, thank you for hitting the download button on this episode of the show. We're back with our interview series where we talk with a wide range of talent within the film and television industry. Tonight's guest is an excellent film and television composer. He's won 2 Emmy Awards for Legend of the Seeker and Xena Warrior Princess, and has been nominated a total of 11 times. Some additional highlights include scoring Sam Raimi's Evil Dead series and Brotherhood of the Wolf. And since 2013, he's been collaborating with Chucky creator Don Mancini on the latest iterations of The Evil Doll, which includes scores for Curse of Chucky, Cult of Chucky, plus the brand new sci-fi and USA series Chucky. Real Talk is proud to welcome Detroit native Mr. Joseph Loduca. Joseph, welcome to Real Talk. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Wes. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, before we get to the new Chucky series, let's go back to 2013, whenever you first started collaborating with Don Mancini. And I'm curious how that relationship with Don formed and what drew you to the Chucky franchise.
Don was looking for a composer for a film he had just completed, Curse of Chucky. And my agent, Richard Kraft, introduced us. And he's really good at making these sort of musical marriages. And Donna and I hit it off right away. It mentioned really upon first meeting him. I said, you know, this movie that you made, it's about a paraplegic that's trapped in a house with Chucky. And there's this elevator that she has to get up and down. And somehow she has to find a way to try to defeat Chucky. I said, you know, it reminds me of a film I saw many years ago as a kid, like on Saturday morning television. It was Olivia de Havilland. And she's tortured by a young James Caan with hair and hairy chest. And, you know, he's really just evil. And he said, yeah. And I forgot what it's called. Oh, Bird in a Cage, I think it was called. And he said, yeah, that's where I got the idea. And so it was obviously a marriage made in the stars. We were destined to be together. And it grew from there. We get one another. Besides being a great filmmaker, Don's has an encyclopedic knowledge of film and film music, really. And that filters into his work on the Chucky series. And so, you know, we are able to kind of have this shorthand of all these things that have influenced us. And the movies were different. Each of the movies was different. And the series is really kind of different, although the sensibilities and how we approach it remain the same.
Well, as a side note, I absolutely love what you did with the Curse of Chucky score. And I was trying to figure out what the instrument was. And I was like, is he doing that with a xylophone or what is that? And then I read that it was a toy piano that you had composed that score on. So I just wanted to let you, I thought it was a great theme. And I also, just for the film's sake, I thought it was the best of the movie since the original Child's Play. So anyway, that's not really a question. I was just telling you that.
Well, the idea was the first question I asked Don was, I don't really know too much about the canon of Chucky. Is there anything I'm supposed to be aware of musically? And he said, no, just let's just work on the film I just completed. And so I said, well, does Chucky have the theme? And he said, nothing that's really stuck. And I said, can I write one? There was a main title sequence, as you know, in Curse. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what if it was, I thought to myself, well, what if it was a Saturday, kind of had a Saturday morning jingle little to it. And Chucky's a toy. So what about a toy piano? So I went out and got this guy here. So,
yes.
And it worked out really well, and it kind of when it's transferred to orchestra, it's got kind of a sinister quality, and it works really well. We got a lot of mileage out of that theme in the movies and in the series.
No, I think it's great. I'm glad you played that for us live here on Real Talk as well.
So awesome. Getting a lot of use lately, as you can imagine.
So we'll fast forward just a little bit, and then the decision was made to do a sequel to Cult of Chucky, but instead of doing another film, they decided to go the route of a TV series. So when approached with that project, what was your initial thought, and were you, again, ready to dive back into the world of Chucky? Because this was going to be the third time.
Yeah, I think, I read the script, and had it not been for COVID and the formation of Peacock by Universal, the streaming service, this series probably could have been done a few years ago, but it had been delayed. When I read the pilot, what struck me was Don's very aware of his fans and that rabid fan base, and so he didn't disappoint there. He had some very unique things going on in the pilot, which I won't spoil you with, but and that also the idea of throwing Chucky, which basically represents pure chaos, into a middle school, a suburban middle school, with all of the drama of middle school and all of the drama of parents and their relationships and what happens when you throw Chucky into the mix, and the havoc that he can create in everyone's lives. So I thought he'd done a great job there. But I also knew that because we were focusing on these middle school kids and that the push of the series was kind of as a YA series. I mean, that's why it's on USA as well, simultaneously on Sci-Fi, that I was going to probably need to really up my game and really kind of take a newer approach to the horror and work with the music that was freshly scary, that was new, not to rely on cliches. And what I didn't know until I saw the first episode was the amount of songs that were being licensed. So I got to navigate through all of that as well. So it was an interesting challenge.
Well, you stated in an interview that what used to be scary isn't scary anymore. So you have to be innovative and come up with new ways to sound scary. And you pointed out jump scares just aren't going to get the same reactions that they used to. And I think your quote was, you have to get them with dread. So a two-part question on that. First, how were you able to incorporate that idea into the music for Chucky?
Well, mostly for me, it was exploring new sounds. And a lot of the sounds that you hear in the series they may start off as an organic sound. That's something you see that's in this room, but by the time I get through with it, it's indistinguishable. It's been heavily mangled and strangled and distorted and all kinds of things going on with it, you know, and all these tools that we have available now with the software. That would have taken forever and probably were impossible before, are readily available. That's been the most fun for me, is finding that. And I think that more and more, I think for horror, a lot of it is this old idea of, I don't know what that is, but it's really creepy. I can't identify that. Is that a violin? Is that a tuba? What is it? You know?
Exactly, like with the toy piano. I was like, yes, you know, I was trying to figure out. I was like,
toy piano, even it's interesting because most of the keyboard sounds in Chucky, they're all processed. I mean, even that, if I use that sound, it's even going to be more heavily detuned and bit reduced in a way where it's just sounds like it's scratchy or through an old warped tape recorder. There are just all kinds of things that I might do with that sound.
You're so experienced within the horror genre. I'm curious if you think that the horror industry is finally catching on to scaring people with dread and atmosphere, because for quite a few years, we really got movies that were pretty heavily relying on jump scares. Are you seeing a shift within the horror genre?
Jump scares is still there. There's even a few in Chucky, you know, but they're not. It's not as though you've got to do, you know, one every 15 minutes anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it's part of the canon. It will always be a part of the canon, you know, and even working with a jump scare is there's a craft to that. You know, there's a craft in the editing, there's a craft in the sounding, there's a craft in the way to set it up, which could work or not work, or you can see it coming from a mile away. So I think it's more about when you see a genre movie, what you're trying to do most of all is really not let the audience off the hook. Or if you are, it's only because you're going to hook them deeper. So that's always the kind of, that's the technique.
Yeah, I feel like whenever they're earned, those jump scares are earned, they can be really effective.
There you go. Good word. Yes, Wes. Earned.
So recently, two of my favorite horror movies came out with series. And I told T-Man about this, but I haven't like finished the statement. I recently watched the I Know What You Did Last Summer series, and I like got to episode 4. I didn't really like it. I turned it off. And, you know, I've been striving to make Real Talk a show podcast too, which has been really grinding their gears. But I watched the Chucky series, and it is fantastic. So people that are listening to this that have not watched the Chucky series, it's even reviewed well. It's fantastic. You should check out the Chucky series if you're a fan.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's something, was it 94, 95 on Rotten Tomatoes?
Yeah.
We got renewed, so that's the biggest validation you can get.
So you're going to get to make more creepy sounds with small pianos and things like that, right, Joe?
Yeah, well, I'll find more creepy things. I've got this thing sitting over in the corner there that I haven't had a chance to work with, some sort of big whirligig thing that really makes a very low bull roarer type of sound.
Maybe we should just come up with a strange object that we want you to incorporate into a song, like an air conditioner or something, and just see if you can do it.
Real talk, we'll mail it up to you.
Former challenge.
You can do it. We have faith in you.
It's like Chopped, the soundtrack edition. We're gonna make you do it with like random
objects. Right. Starting now.
And they'll be like, what is this? What are you playing? The Real Talk guys, they sent it to me. I've got to incorporate it.
Yeah.
Well, that was
Bobby Flay with a meat grinder, right?
Well, that was that on as far as the Chucky section, that was the last question that I was going to ask. I was going to make sure that I saw that where it was renewed, it's going to be premiering season 2 in 2022. And I was just going to make sure, you know, you were going to come back and I was actually going to ask, were you currently working on any new music for the series?
Well, no, I mean, it has yet to be revealed. I mean, Don's pitched the series. He's got an overview, but I think we're, you know, all of us that are, you know, waiting for it to be shot we're waiting.
Gotcha.
I haven't seen a script. I don't think there is a script yet. I think they're all, you know, everybody's lying in a ragged heap after just trying to make the air date of the finale still. Mm-hmm. It was a mad dash to the finish, as you can imagine. I mean, you've got puppeteers you have to erase and all of that footage. You have all kinds of special effects. You have lots of music to write, lots of music to clear from the song. So it's been quite an effort, really.
So it sounds like it's, once they do start getting things shot, it sounds like it's a mad dash for you to come up with some stuff to put in there.
It goes down pretty quickly. It does. But it's always the game. And for me, it isn't as though, you know, I've done a couple of sitcoms, which comparatively are a joke, no pun intended, in terms of the amount of work that they require, as opposed to doing drama or horror, where, you know, you were doing 80 to 90% of the on-air time with music wall to wall. So yeah, there's always a lot of notes when I'm involved.
Well, I just have a couple more questions and then I'll see if the guys have any, but I wanted to take you back to Detroit in the 70s.
Uh-oh.
And you and some friends, I understand, played in a band together, and you wound up opening for Bob Seger and Ted Nugent. I was just curious. I was just thinking about that today. And I was like, wonder if he has any good stories, you know, from then, or at least like one of the big takeaways, you know, from this time period in your life. Cause honestly, it sounds like a blast.
You know, we were tweens, you know, we were kids who picked up instruments early. Music's always been a part of my life. And we're lucky enough to have a drummer's mom who is committed to driving us around. You know, we converted a milk truck and we could play. You know, we were little, we were cute, but we could play. And so we were able to sort of talk our way into opening in these clubs. These were clubs, you know, and there were probably dozens of them around the metropolitan area. And it was the beginning of the rock scene. You know, Detroit was a regional rock scene, but that spawned a lot of legendary names, right? So we'd go on at 8. You know, the headliner wasn't even there in the club yet. But we'd go and we'd play our cute little set and do our blues covers and our Cream covers and whatever tickled our fancy at that point. And but there would be, you know, Ted Nugent was in, well, I'm thinking of Scott Richard Case. He wasn't in Scott Richard Case. I'm trying to think of the name. Amboy Dukes. Oh, that's what it was. Amboy Dukes. And the drummer for the Amboy Dukes many years later became my engineer. Actually, he actually did a lot of work with Eddie Kramer at Electric Ladyland later in the 70s. So it was just such a vibrant time that we didn't know it was there. And then, you know, again, underage getting into the Grandy Ballroom, which was our version of the Fillmore East or West, band would drive up and out of, you know, and out of the van would spill Eric Clapton, and they'd go and, you know, they'd go have dinner at somebody's house down the street because they were as all of you known your friends to be in bands. I mean, that's what the way it was. The Who would come through Detroit, and then they'd go play Chicago and Cleveland. And then a week later, they'd be back at the Grandy Ballroom. So it was an amazing time to just be a fly on the wall and absorb all that music. And it was great, but my musical pursuits were going to keep, you know, growing and growing and growing. So, you know, because I was in Detroit, really got into the jazz scene here. So many of the players that were left behind by the Motown session guys, they were jazz musicians, really. And then stayed in Detroit and played gigs. And I had the opportunity to learn with them and play with them on gigs. So, you know, it was just a great time to grow up in that era. It just so happened that I, you know, found this way of writing for film because I found out that I was actually good at storytelling as well. Many brilliant, brilliant musicians, far more brilliant than I, but maybe aren't gifted with the storytelling gene. So I found the best place.
You created a question for me and a follow-up question. First of all, how old were you when you said you were young? How old were you?
I was like, you know, 13, 14, 15. I mean, you know.
13, 14, 15, playing at these clubs?
Well, yeah, but really the whole idea is that we were protected. You know, so if the band mom might let us stay for when the MC5 came on, which would just be helter-skelter, would just be crazy, you know.
Who converted the milk truck into a driving around?
You know, she found somebody to do it. You know, a milk truck is just, it's a van. It's the precursor to the van.
I'm asking because you achieved my dream at like 13. I always wanted a milk truck band just driving around to clubs. You achieved it at 13 years old. I knew you were going to say it was like 12 or 13 years old playing at clubs. And so then you're like, where do I go from here? I guess I'll just write stories for movies. Is that how it progressed? Yeah, is that how you got into movies?
Years of training in between.
I feel like he achieved more at 13 than we've achieved in our late 30s.
Yes.
See, I'd already done it. It was time to move on.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another story. So around that time, a little after that time in high school, we'd formed a band called the Weekend Freedom Machine. Which actually was stolen, which was the sort of the advertising slogan of Toro Lawnmowers, the Weekend Freedom Machine. So that was our group, you know, psychedelic era. I was one of the, you know, have you ever seen a card for a wedding band, right? They'd be the Perloid kind of thing. And my phone number would be there along with our band manager at that point, who was basically a senior in high school. If you will. So he would, we'd play at the clubs and they'd be at these, you know, whatever they'd be in, strip malls, whatever. And so he put them in the windshield of all the cars. Well, this was also during the era of, you know, the MC5, the White Panthers, the FBI dossiers on John Sinclair. You know, it was that time. So an FBI agent calls the house, right? And my mom answers the phone and said, yes, and you know, this is so-and-so, and we're from blah, 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 and we'd like to see, is Joseph there? I say, yes, yes. Yeah, he's here. And she sounds very strange. She goes, you want to talk to him about what? You know, and she hands me the phone. And, of course, you know, I don't think my voice had changed. Yes. Yes, sir. It's like, you know, he was going to grill me on subversive activities. And found out he's got this kid on the other end of the line.
Did he hang up? Did he freeze?
Yeah, it was just sort of like never mind. It was a big never mind.
Right.
Oh, that's amazing.
That is a good story.
And so when I read that today, I was just like, I've got to ask him about that, because I guarantee he's got stuff. So I appreciate
you sharing. I've been around that long. That's how it started, you know.
I like how you glossed over. You just went, yeah, there's some training in between when I just said you just went straight to movies.
Yeah. The last question that I have, and T-Man, I'm not for sure if you were going to ask this or not, but I just wanted to make sure that we captured it. Of course, like T-Man said at the beginning, you know, we all like love Evil Dead and the series. I was just curious. I know Evil Dead, of course, came out in 1981. And it was the first film that you composed. And I was curious about the story of how you even got attached to doing the music for that.
Yeah. Well, I was introduced by someone I had met from kind of being around the studios to actually a filmmaker who was helping Sam and Bruce and Rob raise some money to finish the film. They'd already been to Tennessee, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shooting cabin in the woods. But there was still a lot of work to do, and they were looking for a composer. And so we were put together. I went to their office. They had an office. It was an office next to a magic shop in Ferndale, Michigan, that, you know, a magic shop that sold things like whoopee cushions and cigarettes that turned your mouth black and whatever.
You know, real magic.
That's
real magic to me.
And that was right. And that was right next door to Renaissance Pictures. Was their moniker. I went into their office. You know, they have action figures on the windowsills. It was sparsely decorated. Had some freeze dried coffee, warmed up over a hot plate, and was asked if I could write some scary music. And I went, yeah, sure. And I did that. And from the basis of that demo, we moved forward. But I had no clue how to put music to picture. And it was painful. The tools were not what we have nowadays. And it took a really long time to make it work. But it was fun. And something, you know, the budgetary restrictions actually were perfect for the movie. 5 string players and me getting my hands on anything that'll make a sound, recording in an attic studio is the perfect way to score a ramshackle cabin in the woods, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. I've always loved that movie for many years, and I was just kind of curious how that came together, because I knew a little bit about how they filmed it.
Right.
And so I was like, exactly like what you were saying, you know, going down to a cabin in the woods in Tennessee on a micro budget. And I found out that was the first film you composed. And I was like, that is really cool. So I had to ask you about that. But that's all the questions for me. So, T-Man, if you want me to flip it over to you, I think you had some stuff.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And that was a great lead-in, Wes. I just have a few questions, Joseph, just around your long collaboration with, of course, Sam and Bruce and Robert and Ted. And of course, real talk, as you all know from listening to our horror movie convention episode, we met Ted Raimi just a few weeks ago. Sort of. We are, he thinks we do an S&M podcast, which I think some people really do think that when they listen to our episodes. It could be torture to some people.
Yeah, he was slightly creeped out by me, but then he grew to love me by the end.
After a few minutes, he grew to love us, I'm pretty sure. Maybe not.
Same thing that happened with my wife. Go ahead.
Whole other question. But I just want to ask you a few, because you have a long collaboration with them. You know, the first question that really popped in my mind was your score of Army of Darkness, which is one of my favorite scores, honestly. I love that score so much. And so I just found it really interesting that, of course, you've done Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2. And Army of Darkness, of course, is a total tonal shift from more of a comedic, you know, tone in the medieval ages. How did you go about with that switch from the Evil Dead 1 and 2 to going into Army of Darkness? You just mentioned how, you know, you're a storyteller with your music. Did you have to was that a big challenge to change that score into more of that swashbuckling, I guess, type of musical score that you went with that?
The biggest challenge was 3.5 weeks. That was really the biggest challenge. Kind of just from seeing the footage, it was sort of obvious what it was, right? It's a send up of, to me, it's kind of a send up of a Harryhausen movie, if you will. Things that I would have seen as a kid growing up on Saturday mornings. And I was well versed, of course, in the crazy Raimi Campbell collaboration of physical comedy and Three Stooges influence and, you know, all of that. No, I think in some ways it was the easiest one to write because it kind of relied on certain conventions that we know. It's part of the filmic canon, part of the cinematic canon. So, you know, to have swashbuckling scenes, to have medieval source music in the palace, to go all out comedy once you ash splinters into 40 little ashes. And becomes a cartoon, basically.
Right.
What was great is I got the montage when that was my favorite cue because it's a montage and nobody's talking.
Amazing montage, yeah.
It's when, you know, Ash decides to become a hero and with his chemistry 101 book decides he's going to blow the Deadites to smithereens. So there's that. Actually, my second favorite scene, I think, is only in the initial Japanese version, or the one that was released first, which was Ash takes 3 drops too many and finds himself in a post-apocalyptic future. A very trippy sequence.
Right. That's a good sequence, too.
It's the alternate ending.
Right. Yeah. Kind of dark, right? Much darker.
Yeah. 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 Which was, I guess the powers that be decided they wanted a happy ending, if you will.
Exactly. No, that makes a lot of sense though. And then I had to ask you about your 90s run with, I believe it's still the same production company, Robert Tabor. They did all of these. I think they were syndicated. It was Hercules, Legendary Journey. I loved those shows, you know, growing up. And I just want to ask, and you kind of touched on it with the Chucky series, how big of a change it was to doing that type of, you know, syndicated television. Was it a challenge or did you like
the sheer volume of it? I mean, Chucky is a little bit of a revisit of those days. But it, you know, Hercules and Xena for the most part went on simultaneously. And toward the end there, we added Bruce Campbell in Jack of All Trades.
Right. Yeah. And Ted, right? Wasn't Ted in that?
I think he was in that. He was a frequent.
He guest starred. That's right. Yeah.
He was like, you know, very much a cast member in Xena, Joxer the Mighty.
Yes.
Yeah. He was that's like kind of reoccurring character. Yeah.
Yes, he was.
Right. So
just watch it. Didn't like us. We got it wrong.
He was sure. You know. Well, it was everything to get up in the morning, and it was great because it was a blank canvas, and you really had to trust your first instinct because there's just so much music to cover. And what was fun particularly about Xena was, you know, it could get operatic, but it could also get silly. There'd be a run of comedic episodes. We did an operetta for one of the episodes, and then we did a rock musical for one of the episodes. It was actually...
Do you remember that rock episode?
Now you have all these long, you know, season 5, season 6 of any series. Now they do their musical, right? Episode Xena was the first. Really that ventured into that territory. So it was great. And we were a syndicated series, but we had an orchestral budget. And I got to do a lot of things with ethnic musicians and ethnic music, because Zena would go to India and she'd go to Japan, and she, you know, we'd have the Amazon, so we'd have to make up a culture of musical, you know, idioms for that. So yeah, it was a great, great time.
And you did every episode of those shows?
Yeah, there was, I mean, I think that particular span between Hercules and Xena and the other episodes, the other two series I mentioned, and I think there was an animated Xena movie. There was Young Hercules starring none other than, come on, The Notebook.
Ryan Gosling,
a young Ryan Gosling.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I remember that show. I didn't know he was in that.
Oh, he was. It was like two seasons. He was young Hercules, a skinny young Hercules.
So are you making up new songs for each episode, or are you reusing a lot of the same songs?
Good question. The cues could be freely, with the help of a music editor, you know, that we'd sort that out. You know, in some episodes were, what are they called, bottle episodes, where you literally be playing parts of other shows. But it would all depend, as it does with Chucky and any series I've ever worked on, it depends on the writers. If the writers are going to put our characters in new situations and new environments, that's going to demand a lot of new music. You know, if we've kind of been there, done that, music may reflect that, and we may reuse quite a bit of it. So just depends. Definitely those types of shows, especially for syndicated television, rely heavily on, you know, my knight in shining armor, my music editor. So
I was like a closet late night Xena Princess Warrior fan for a long time. Like, cause you know, it came on late at
night.
Why
are you a closet fan? That's a great show.
Well, I did it. I mean, later on it became cool. So I started admitting that I was a Xena Princess Warrior fan, but I mean, the reason I asked that question, there's like hundreds of Xena episodes.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I'd say 148, something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, I was always the Hercules fan.
It was like doing Chucky.
Well, like the Spanish. The Spanish love Hercules more than Xena. Don't ask for
that. I learned that
when I played a couple concerts in Spain. Yeah.
Interesting. They approach you with Chucky and
they're like, don't play the Xena, play more Hercules.
No, I'm really curious. When they approach you with Chucky and they were like, it's just going to be seven episodes, you're like, oh, I can do that in an afternoon probably, right?
No, it wasn't quite like that, but I know the. Let's put this
way, a little harsh.
I know the rhythm and the grind of TV rather well. Yeah, I've been doing it for so long. I know what it's going to take.
Yeah, that film. And then also, I want to ask you about, I believe you did the new Ash versus Evil Dead show too.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You went back
three seasons of that. Uh huh.
Yeah, also a great show, and you went back into that world. How is it like being back into the Evil Dead world after so many years, kind of being away from it?
Well, Sam directed the first episode, so that was fun. So we, you know, he came up to the orchestra date, and it was a great, you know, fun reunion that way. I also, a few years ago, I rewrote the score to Evil Dead. And there's a print out there that's been touring around. I did it as a sort of a labor of love. And Mondo did a 2-record vinyl release of it. And it was kind of fun because, like I said, that initial idea of making scary music with just a few string players, there's something really more intimately scary about that. I took it upon myself to kind of go that way because I always pitch that idea and I always get shot down. It's like, no, popcorn must fly. Sorry.
Right. The one other question I had, and this is going to be like, where did this come from? But I was looking at your filmography and I always remember this TV miniseries. I don't know if anybody else probably remembers it. It's The Triangle from the early 2000s. And I always really liked that TV miniseries. Never seen it since. Like, I don't know if it's on DVD. I need to get it again. But what was it like working on that show and just being or on a movie? And is there any difference between, let's say, a TV miniseries versus like a theatrical film that you've done?
Well, at this point, my sort of second longest collaboration has been with Dean Devlin, who's known for Independence Day and The Patriot and Godzilla and Stargate, and we met on the first Librarians movie. He called me in for that. It was Noah Wiley. And it's sort of in what happens if Indiana Jones is a nerd, a smart nerd who has to be protected by a strong woman. You know, that's kind of the encapsulation of those movies. And The Triangle was the second outing. And he's also, you know, also known for sci-fi as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a cool one. It was very cool. One of the interesting sidelines of that score was when you go through the triangle, you could end up in an alternate universe. And it turns out that Australians are basically Nazis. You go into this brief little time warp thing. And there is some sort of national anthem that's supposed to be playing over the bullhorns, the speakers. And so I thought to myself, what is the most depressing national anthem on the planet today? Turns out, if you've ever listened to the Bulgarian national anthem, you really want to commit suicide. It's very. I'm sure
I thought he was going to say Kazakhstan, but
I thought, you know, no disrespect, but it is definitely one of the saddest marches.
We are big in Bulgaria, I think, but.
Well, some journalist was trying to start some sort of, you know, I don't know. This is before Twitter. You know, I was getting calls like, do you know that the desecration of our national anthem is a crime and you can be prosecuted?
Like, oh, wow.
And some, you know, nationalist Bulgarians took umbrage with it. It was kind of funny.
You know,
it's a sci-fi movie. It's not really supposed to be real.
So I guess you're not exactly going to Bulgaria anytime soon.
I think the Bulgarians love me because of Xena, actually.
Yeah, that's true. You've got the Trump card.
Yeah. No, that's great. That initial theme is heavily Bulgarian influenced. It was a great husband and wife team that was playing the instruments and singing on that score.
I've just got two quick questions. One's one of my normal off the wall questions, and one's a serious question that's going to throw these guys off. But my off the wall question is, and I'm serious about it though. I've always wanted to talk to a composer. I dabble a little bit in piano and guitar, and the guys know it. But I feel like when you play an instrument, you play what you feel, and you know method actors, right, Joe? You know, people that get really into the part that they're going to play, like Become It. Do you do that as a composer? Are you a method Absolutely. Composer?
Oh, buddy, you got it. At least in my case. I have to somehow find a way to generate a genuine response to the material. If I can't, I mean, I'm no good at what I do. Mm. You know, I have to find a way into the material. And so I have to find some sort of emotional connection to it. And it's like being an actor, I think, you know.
So when you get into this really dark stuff, do you go to a dark place in your life?
Yeah, that's why I kind of find it exhausting sometimes, you know. I mean, uh-huh. Writing action scenes is an athletic event. I'm tired.
Yeah.
after doing them. I think that... I can't speak for anybody else, but for me, it's I have to expend that kind of emotional energy to actually generate something that feels authentic, especially in the fact that, like Chucky, I mean, you know, I'm the only musician on the Chucky score.
Yeah.
I hired a singer to sing the last cue in episode 8, and that's it. You know, so in order to kind of make these freeze-dried sounds come to life. I mean, it's, you know, you've got to really pour your heart into it.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense.
I'm a very honest person. I have, going into this interview, I'd seen three of your shows. I'd seen Chucky, I've seen Xena, and I'd seen He-Man.
Hercules.
No, He-Man.
Hercules.
He-Man?
Oh. I thought He-Man Masters of the Universe, he did that, didn't you?
I did. Oh, ooh, yeah, I did. I forgot about that. Thanks.
That's all I gave here.
I did a couple seasons when Mattel when Mattel took over the franchise, and they did a couple years of two seasons, I think, of He-Man, Masters of the Universe. Yeah.
Gabe could be your Gabe. You need to manage Joseph's IMDb. You've got.
I'll take care of it. But when I was looking through it, the movie that stuck out to me, and I love this soundtrack so much, it was this off-the-wall movie back when you could go to video stores. Man, we miss video stores. I remember walking. It was like 2002 or 3-ish. And, you know, I love these adventure movies. And I walked in, I grabbed.
I already know what you're going to say. Here you go. Keep going.
I walk in, I grabbed this movie, and it was the first foreign film I think I'd ever seen. It was Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Oh, yeah.
And did you know that's what I was going to say, T-Man?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it is
awesome. Awesome movie. Awesome score.
Awesome movie. And it's not like most of the stuff you ever did. It's like it's a creature feature, like kind of like mystery. But it is kind of horror, I guess, adjacent, I guess you could say, because I think the creature eats people or something in the beginning.
Well, it's kind of a werewolf. It is the French equivalent of the Legend of Sleepy Hollow, kind of.
That's cool. Yeah.
I loved that movie. And I think. And I'm reading on here, you won an award for that score because I was like, I don't remember a lot of your work, but that score is truly awesome. Like, how did you get involved with that? And was like, because it's overseas. How did they get in contact with you? Like, was it just out of the blue?
Well, the connection is quite direct. The distribution company initially for Evil Dead. Was through the company which also was the producer of Brotherhood of the Wolf, and the director of Brotherhood of the Wolf was actually a journalist turned filmmaker. Gustav Gans, and I had written the music for his first film, which was called Necronomicon, which was an anthology of H.P. Lovecraft. And so this was his second movie, and he had asked me to work on this, and he really knocked it out of the park for his second try of a film. It was the highest grossing film of its time, and it had outgrossed Star Wars. It had outgrossed in France.
Yeah.
Kind of funny. I said, how's it feel to have the highest grossing film and only a Frenchman did this? Yes, they will never let me forget it. So, yes, it was nominated for a César that year, which is their Oscar. But it was also the year a lovely film called Amélie came out.
Mm-hmm. So that's a great
movie. That's iconic. Good movie. French really good accordions, movie. You know, it's definitely it. It was great. And it's funny you mentioned that score, because that score kind of encapsulates everything I love to do by being a film composer, which was, you know, to get some Indian Lakota flutes and make some wild themes and sounds on that, to play a lot of instruments, to have an eclectic approach to an historical movie. There's, you know, takes place in the 18th century, but that's not what the music sounds like. But there's orchestra. There is a little bit of horror. There's capoeira, Brazilian capoeira drumming for a fight. There's rock guitars. There's a pop song in the end credits. There's choral music. There's solo vocalists. So, I mean, it's all of the above. And I got to do that in one movie, which was a great adventure.
It's got a big following to this day.
I think it's been re-released. Somebody told me it had been recently re-released on Blu-ray.
Yeah, it's about $30 too, because I looked into buying it recently.
Okay, yeah. And then I think Shudder's playing it. Somebody told me it's on Shudder now.
Oh yeah, I'd love to rewatch that.
It's great. Come on. Bellucci is the madam of a brothel who is a spy for the Pope.
I point blank remember renting it, and I was like, I was like, this movie is awesome. I was like, how? I didn't know what I was getting into, but I do remember
Vincent
that.
Vincent Cassell's in it? Yeah.
Vincent Cassell, Jeremy Renner.
Yes.
He's in that too.
Don't blink, Jeremy Renner. Don't blink, or you'll miss him.
That's right. Yeah. That's awesome.
All right. I mean, last question. So are you going to write us a theme on that tiny piano for our podcast? Because that's really, that's my final question. Like, I just want a small slivet of a theme for our show. I mean, this is how we corner you. I mean, we get you live on air. You can barely say no.
Okay.
There we go.
There we go.
I'm gonna take that snippet and start putting it at the beginning of the show and just say, our score was composed by Joseph Loduca.
Wow, that's amazing.
Joseph's gonna be like, Sears, say thank you so much for being on Real Talk. Fun. It was such a pleasure to have you. And
happy holidays to you and your families, all your youngins.
Happy holidays to you as well, and I'll cut us a quick outro here, and then we will stop taking up your evening.
All right, be well.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Joseph.
Bye, guys.
Bye, bye.
Audience, you can check out the new Sci-Fi and USA Network TV series Chucky on Hulu, Peacock, YouTube TV, etc. And we really hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, a couple of things you can do to support our efforts here at Real Talk. Subscribe to our show on your favorite podcast platform. Anytime we release a new episode, it'll download to your library and be waiting for you. And if you get a chance, leave us a review or rating on that platform as well. That just really helps for the show to show up. Unfortunately, it's the quantity over quality, which is definitely in our case. We'd love to hear from you. Social media, Twitter, @real_cast, that's R-E-E-L, Real Talk, a movie podcast page on Facebook. We're over on Instagram as well, official Real Talk Podcast. And for us, that's a wrap.